Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Peach State Pandemonium. Rich Tate with you this week, as I have been for the last several. And, of course, Jay West, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons on the line with us. Guys, how are you doing this week?
Well, I'm trying to call out. How about you?
Doing all right. Everybody digging out okay?
Oh, yeah, I'm doing fine.
Yeah, I saw my post. I saw my postman for the first time in 3 days. I guess they don't take that oath anymore about rain, sleet, and snow, or if they do, they don't take it very seriously.
Is Jerry with us?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, how's the weather down there, sir?
He got a little bit of ice. Nothing, they closed the schools, but everybody could get around.
Oh,
I talked to Greg Brown before we went on air. He got trapped on 285 for 24 hours.
God love him. We had two women that worked with us that they left work on, we all left about 1:30 Tuesday, and they got home this morning.
Wow.
They had to sleep in a pizza place Tuesday night. They got back to their car yesterday, and the car was so iced in and there were so many cars around it that they couldn't get it out, so they had to go back to the pizza place, stay again last night, and they finally got out this morning and went home.
Man.
I got home in 3.5 hours, and I thought I had a rough trip.
Rich, how'd you do?
I did all right. I actually paid attention to the weather Tuesday morning, just basically told work, hey, I've got like an hour commute from the office to home, so I noticed that morning, you know, that the weather pattern was kind of shifting, and by the time I got to work, everybody else had already started talking about that. Then I happened to notice at about 9:30 it was starting to hit Douglasville, so it was time for me to start heading home, and I know they shut down about an hour later. And,
well, actually,
we just all worked from the house.
Actually, Sunday night, they'd started making the predictions about what was going to take place on Tuesday. And, you know, anybody in their right mind that didn't have to get out, obviously there were some folks that did, should have anticipated that all it takes is a half inch of snow in the city of Atlanta and the place is shut down. But my wife and I did what we needed to do on Monday, and since we're in the elderly crowd at AARP and don't have a 9-to-5 job anymore, we were ready for Tuesday, and I really felt for the folks that, didn't have any choice. They had to get out there. But the call on the school closings was, really, really a bad call. That what happened here shouldn't have happened.
No, and you know, the bad thing is, and I don't want to get political here, but I think Governor Deal and Mayor Reed specifically, I think both of them are taking kind of a hard hit for some stuff that really, you don't want government involved in. I think schools should have decided whether or not they stayed open or sent kids home or, you know, whatever.
Well, that's the county, they're separate and they can make that decision.
And they should have.
Yes.
And they didn't. A lot of kids stuck at schools overnight. That was pretty bad stuff. Getting on to other stuff. What's the latest on Mike Norris?
I saw Mike on when did I see him? Saw him Monday night on his birthday. He was his old self. He's like I say, he's very alert. He's talking. He's got his computer. I don't know if he's listening tonight or not. He does have his computer, and he is messing with it. And he's lost a good bit of weight. You know, I figure he's lost over 100 pounds,
wow,
which I would love to do, but not the way he did it. But he looks good, he sounds good, and they got him up in a chair Monday for 6.5 hours, but he's still not able to use his legs. So they're still doing the therapy and different things. They've mentioned a couple of therapy locations possibly and moving him to Macon, and then they also mentioned moving him to Warm Springs. So I really don't know where we're at yet with that, but he's doing okay. He's, like I say, he's on the road to recovery. It's just a long road.
All right. Well, guys, we had a great show a couple weeks ago talking about the 2003 class of the Georgia Wrestling Hall of Fame, and tonight I want to talk about 2004 class. And I know I sent you guys an email while, you know, making sure you remembered all the names of that year's inductees, and maybe you could refresh your memories and jog some memories and whatnot. But first up for discussion tonight. We kind of touched on him here and there last week, but I know I kind of held Charlie Smith off a bit. But Charlie Harmon.
Well, Charlie hired me. He gave me my first job in the wrestling business. He hired me to. It's his fault. He hired me to put the TV ring up in Atlanta and also to run errands for him out of the, you know, out of the office. And Charlie was a great guy to me. He was I saw Charlie wrestle a couple of times. Of course, it was very late in his career when they were doing special angles, such as him and Gunkel wrestle for Eddie Blassie one time, and just different things they did like that. But I never got to see him, you know, of course, in his prime. I've never even seen him on tape or film, if there's any out there. I don't even know that there is, but just a super guy. Super guy. Funny guy.
He always had something for you, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He was funny.
He always had one for you.
He was funny.
I've just seen photos of him, you know, doing his stance from when he was in his prime. As Bobby mentioned, no film or anything that I've ever seen on any of his matches. My basic memory of him was when he would sit in on that Live Atlanta Wrestling prior to the All South when they split. But he would be the co-host with Ed Capel, and Ed would say, "And now here's Charlie Harbin," and Charlie would say, "Yes, Ed," and they take it from there. And it was always interesting to hear him do color for Ed Capel on Live Atlanta Wrestling. But by most of the stories I've heard have either been obviously through Bobby or, of course, Charlie Smith, who used to tell me that while Charlie Harbin was still with us, that Charlie would talk to him every day. And I thought that was great.
Yeah, he was Charlie was just he was very involved in my life the whole time that he was around, because he was just I always looked up to him and admired him. And, you know, of course, he after the split was over and I came to work for Barnett, and eventually when I wound up in the office working as Barnett's office manager, I still had more dealings with Charlie. He promoted Augusto. They call him the promoter. All Charlie did was go down, and he was the on-site guy that took care of the building, checked up. Of course, in Augusta, we had a bank deposit there. He would go make the bank deposit. He handled Rome for us, and he also handled Chattanooga when we started running Chattanooga. So he would come up. He'd be at the TV station on Tuesday mornings for the interviews. And Charlie remained very active as long as Barnett was around. It was viable. I really don't know what happened after Ole took over. I know he was around for a while, but I don't know how long that lasted.
And when you say that, you mean into 1983, after you left?
Oh, yeah, he was still around. Yeah, he was, I don't know. I mean, you would know more than me looking at the Augusta cards is when he was still the promoter.
Right.
I'm sure when his name disappeared off Augusta, I'm sure that was probably the end of it.
Now the earliest I've seen him wrestle in Georgia was July 1933. For promoter Bill Corley at the Lakewood Park Fight Arena. George Harbin.
Jerry might have been there. I don't know.
The referee.
Yeah.
Now, George Harbin was on that same card. Now, were they legit brothers?
They were brothers, yes.
Okay.
Now, George worked for Jim Crockett. I never met George, but I talked to him 1,000 times on the phone. George was responsible for a lot of the things that I did here in Atlanta for Crockett. And whenever I would need a Social Security number that some guy had failed to give me, or if I had one that he didn't have, we talked generally about once a week. And yeah, George was older. He was the older of the two brothers, and he was. This is a quote from Charlie. He said he was my hero. And when George passed away, the funeral was on a Monday, and I was sitting in the office, and I just assumed that Charlie had gone to Charlotte for the funeral, because I'd asked Barnett if I needed to go to Augusta, or if Charlie was going to cut from Charlotte over to Augusta, which is actually a closer trip than from Atlanta. And he said he wasn't sure. Charlie hadn't called him, and then Charlie walked in the office, and it shocked me. And it was the only time I ever seen him shed a tear. I asked him about it, and he welled up, and he told me, he said, he was my hero. He said, I cannot go up there and look at him in a box. He said, I'll remember him the way he was. And he went to Augusta. But
he started refereeing here in the 50s, I want to say. When did he stop working as a referee? It was in the 70s, right?
No, before that, I think. Cool. I mean, he probably late 60s, I would think. I'm not sure. Now, he might have went into the early 70s, but I don't.
Okay.
When you started, did he work any of your matches?
I don't think he did, Bobby.
Yeah, I think he had quit by the 60s, late 60s. Because
yeah,
Charlie Smith and Eddie Smith, and there was a guy named, there was another Smith here. God, what was his name?
Red Smith.
Yeah, they were doing the bulk of the refereeing, and then Bill McMahon came into the picture, and he did some. But Charlie did pretty well. He was managing the office for Ray, and that was about all he did.
Okay.
I think there were a few gimmick matches that he may have been like special referee on and things like that. I think Leo Garibaldi ran a thing where he was with the booker, I guess, and he was also a ref, and I think he had something with Buddy Colt, and I think Charlie Harbin may have been named as a, you know, kind of a special referee for that match or something. I remember the thing with Garibaldi. He had I forget exactly how it went, but Buddy Colt may have had one hand tied behind him or something. But anyway, they promoted it on TV, and it was pretty interesting. But that was one of the few times I ever saw Charlie Harbin actually involved in what was taking place, other than just doing color commentary on the air.
The next name in the Hall of Fame is another guy who got into... another guy that dates back to the 1930s, at least in the ring, Don McIntyre. May 1935, I show him wrestling for promoter Jack Browning in Augusta long before the territory started up. But, of course, he goes on to be a key person in the office and booking and promoting and whatnot until 1964 when he sold out to Buddy Fuller. What can you guys tell us about him?
I met him in the 70s. He lived a couple of blocks from Ann Gunkel, and I met him, you know, but it was way after he was out of the business. There again, that at some point later in the show, that may be a Charlie Smith question, because Charlie probably worked for him at some point. But I can remember him being on TV as the promoter before Paul Jones took it.
I can remember seeing him once again, being a little bit older than Bobby. He was the pre Ray Gunkel face on television, and
right.
They called him out when they needed information or whatnot. He was the face, and he never hardly ever, if ever, even at that point, it was late in his career, would work on television other than just, you know, giving commentary or something of that nature. But he'd still, you know, work matches at the City Auditorium and things like that occasionally. But you didn't see him wrestle on TV, and that was one of the attractions. If you wanted to see him, you'd have to, you know, go to the arena to see him work. Much very similar to the way Ray Gunkel did it. You didn't see him work on TV almost unless they were building some big angle. And then, like you said, when he sold out, that's when I guess Ray Gunkel became the primary face for television.
Right. And I know I talked to his brother Bill one time, and Bill said that when he left here in 64, he pretty much made a clean break of the business. I was always kind of curious, though. He couldn't really give me any information. I don't know if maybe you guys could, about maybe what made him get out of the business, what made him specifically go to Fuller.
I can't tell you that. I have no idea. I know he got real big in real estate.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, now I may be wrong. Here again, this is something maybe that Mr. Smith can clarify, but I'm thinking he bought a bunch of apartments. I heard that or knew that or something, but I think he got real heavy into real estate. And that's what he did with his money, invested it in real estate. And he must have done all right because that neighborhood they were living in out there was not the low-income part of town.
And Jerry, you refereed some of his matches, right?
Yeah.
next in the group, obviously a big name here. This guy started announcing in 1955. He replaced Ray McKay, who was the original host of Live Atlanta Wrestling on TV on Channel 11. Don McIntyre sat in that gig up until November 72. Talk about him.
Well, you know, once I start talking here, it's going to be hard to cut me off. So if Bobby or Jerry want to say anything about him, go ahead.
Well, who are we talking about?
Ed Capel.
Ed Capel.
Ed Capel.
Yeah. I'm sure, I mean, I worked around Ed. I never was worked real close with him, but it's kind of funny the way things work out. When it was Live Atlanta Wrestling and it was actually live, one of the sponsors for the show was Columbia Sewing Machine Company, 816 Gordon Street in Atlanta. My dad was the repairman for Columbia Sewing Machine Company, and once a week, on about an hour or two before the show would go on the air, my dad would take a sewing machine up to the studio, and Ed would do a one-minute promo for Columbia Sewing Machine Company. So I actually met Ed Capel when I was just a kid. I mean, I was probably 4 or 5 years old, but I didn't have a clue what it was, who it was, you know. Him and my dad were acquaintances. They weren't friends, but they knew who each other was, and they spoke. And then after I got into business, we got to talking one day, and Ed remembered my dad, and you know, and we just put two and two together. But Ed was very professional. He had his way of doing things. He was very much the first proponent I ever come across that once the tape started rolling, it didn't stop. That there was no, he never wanted to have to stop the tape, do an edit on the tape. He wanted the show to go from A to Z. Whatever happened, happened. And he always, the reasoning he had with that was, he said, anytime you do an edit, he said, even the dumbest person in the world can tell you've edited a tape on TV when they do it, because you can never get it exactly clean. And he said, it opens your business up for speculation that you've done something to make something different, or you did something happened you didn't want to happen and you changed it. So he wanted it to run A to Z. And then, of course, later on, as I worked with Gordon, it was the same thing. We never stopped tape. Once it started, it went for an hour and it was over. But Ed was Jay may remember this. I don't know, but you know, when we, as technology improved, and they would run down the card for the Omni or the Auditorium or whatever it was, You know, you would have these pictures bleed in and out. You would have these, you know, these computer-generated montages of guys' names and pictures and whatever. When I first started working around the business and first did that, part of my job on Saturday at the TV, Ed would come in and he would have 8x10s of the card for Friday night mounted on foam core or some other type backing, cardboard, colored cardboard, construction paper, whatever. And they would set the pictures up on two music stands, and the director would flip from camera to camera, and my job was to flip the picture so that the next guy would be up there when they came back to my music stand. So it was very a lot of stuff he did was very not technically savvy, but it always got the job done, and he always was on top of things. And he was a darn good commentator, I thought. He did a good job.
I thought he was excellent.
Did a good job.
Well, you know, Ed started out when radio and television, everything was live. So, you know, you didn't have the pre-recorded elements that came later on. So he was, as Bobby talking about the way he would set up, that's what he felt comfortable with, you know, in the beginning. Technology changes, and sometimes it takes you a little while to want to catch up with it. But Ed, you know, was what was called the basic general announcer in television in the 50s. And that's when I was coming along, 7 or 8 years old, and I wanted to, you know, be a radio announcer or TV. And so guys like Ed and Paul Daugherty and Frank Loki and Freddie Miller and Ray McKay were people that, you know, that I remember from the early days in the business, not just from the wrestling area, but from doing other shows like kid shows and the infamous movie hosts that would be on. And you know, Ed got out of that as quickly as he could and got into the advertising business. But that's what he did in the early days of TV. In addition to, you know, being the host on the wrestling TV show, which in those days was something that, in many markets, you know, you would just get handed and say, okay, you're going to be the announcer on the wrestling show. And Ed was great. And you know, to me, he was Mr. Television Announcer Wrestling Guy from Live Atlanta Wrestling. And you know, the only time that I ever talked to him outside of the wrestling area was when I was working at WKHX in 1981, and the program director brought him around through the studios. It was new studios, and I guess he was getting ready to, you know, buy some time for some of his folks that were clients of his. And they brought him into the studio, so anyway, the program director had to go do something else. And I said to Ed, I said, you know, I remember you very well from your days on Live Atlanta Wrestling and then with All South. And then I mentioned to him that I had been ring announcer for Georgia Championship Wrestling. And he kind of gave a little grin, and we chatted for a few minutes. But that was the only time that I ever talked to him. Specifically, was that day in the radio station in 1981. But he's just one of the guys that were, Bobby talked about heroes, and he was just one of the guys that I remember from the early days that, you know, I looked at as somebody in the business who I wanted to copy myself after. And I think he left a great legacy, not only just in wrestling, but in other areas of the broadcast business.
You know, he also, you know, Ed was the ring announcer at the Auditorium on Friday night.
Yes, he was, and he did that for All South also.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, that was unusual. Usually your TV guy didn't do your ring announcing, or most places I went they didn't.
And he did the same on TV, you know, and it was funny because sometimes they'd come back from a quick cut, and Ed would be sitting there at the table without his jacket on.
Right.
You know, that surprised people a little bit because he would get comfortable. He did the ring announcing. He did the whole bit, and he did a, you know, that was, you know, from when I was doing it the first time with Gordon, with those cuts and everything you had to do. The guy that was doing the hosting, he really, you know, he had to think about what was coming up next, and having a different ring announcer gave you an opportunity to kind of take a little break there and think a little bit about what was coming up. So he really had a lot to handle. I would like to say that I remembered Ray McKay prior to Ed doing the show, but I was just too young. What I actually remember is that since everything was live and he was actually a staff announcer for the station in the early days, Ray did come back because he was still working at Channel 11, and he would sit in for Ed a couple of times when Ed would be on vacation or something of that nature in the very early days when Ed was still actually working for the station. But I do remember Ray McKay, not when he was actually the host, but when he would sub occasionally for Ed on the show in the early days.
Ray did the ring announcing for Gunkel when we first went in business.
We
were filming at Oglethorpe. Ray was doing the ring announcing.
Yeah, and he actually, in the very late ends of his career, he worked for Lars Anderson for his little promotion, too, doing the same thing.
I'm sure that was lucrative.
I forgot he did that.
Yeah, and then he did.
He made so much money doing that, he retired.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
He moved to Florida.
Next on the list, and this will get Jerry some airtime. We had Paul Jones last week, and obviously you got Paul Jones, you got to have Fred Ward as well. Fred Ward running Central Georgia for quite some time, Macon, Columbus, Albany, as far south as Albany, Warner Robins, America's. Jerry, tell us about Fred Ward.
I met Fred Ward when I was 5 years old. There was no auditorium there in Columbus, and we'd go to the matches at the, they call it the Mule Barn. That's what it was originally in the day. And that's where they had it. No air conditioning. Small place. I don't know how many that thing would hold. But, I mean, even back then, it used to be on Monday nights. And, you know, they'd fill it up back then. You know, I saw a lot of different guys as a kid come through there. And I guess until they finally closed that building, so... I mean, the Bruiser was there, Snyder was there, Gorgeous George was there, Lou Fez was there. I mean, every name in the game went through that building. And it, you know, then later on they built the auditorium, and then they kept that and used that later on as where we did the live TV. And that building was, if those walls could talk. And I know way before I left there, I rode by there one day, and they had, the family, Mr. Ward had already passed away, and the family had sold the building to W.C. Bradley there. And they had it for a long time, and I rode by there one day, and they was tearing it down. And I said, whoa. So I pulled over, and there was a guy on a bulldozer. And he saw me get out of my car, and he stopped the bulldozer. He said, I know who you are. I said, how you doing, sir? I said, you care if I get some bricks? He said, get all the bricks you want. And I got probably 12 or 15 bricks from it, and I still got them.
Mm.
But it was an interesting place. It was great for TV. You know, they air-conditioned it later on when they got TV, and that's where they did the live TV from. And it was supposedly the last live TV show in the country out of that building.
Is that the sports arena that you're talking about there, is that the one that was the Mule Barn?
Yes, sir.
So that's I knew they ran the live show. I mean, the house shows there for a long time. I'd never heard it referred to as a Mule Barn.
That's what it was, Bobby. Years ago. I'm talking about way back. I don't know how old that building was. That's where they kept the fire horses.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know how long he had it. Well, I know when I was a kid he had it. That's for sure. So. It's been a while, so, you know, but that's where the matches were held. He had boxing there, too, also. And he had a gym upstairs. I don't know if you ever went upstairs.
No.
He had, like, a gym up there. And but that's where Ted learned to wrestle in that building. But it was, it, I mean, it, it's, it's, Oh, and then later on, if something went on at the auditorium, like the fair was in town or something where they couldn't get the building, he would run live matches there. I mean, yeah, you know, not TV, but just house shows.
Yeah, we'd run Wednesday night there when we couldn't get to auditorium. I worked that building on a Wednesday night.
Did you really?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was you know we talk about this a lot about atmosphere. You know they charge. What did he charge? $2 to get in on Saturdays for that 1 hour TV show.
It's about yeah.
And
I
that
think
place
it was
packed every Saturday.
It was, and you, like you said, atmosphere. It had it, didn't it?
Oh,
it was like doing TV was like doing a house show.
Yes, it was.
It was packed, and you know he. Mr. Ward was, not because I was from there and I knew him all those years, he was a special kind of man. You know, Bobby, I know you, I've heard you talk about, you know, the opposition he did, but there's a long story to that.
Right, I know.
You know, so he, it was like when the split come here in the early 70s, it was a mess. It was, I mean, nobody knows what a mess it really was because I got caught right in the middle of it. I just come back, just got booked when the split happened. So I worked for Gunko for like a week, and then I went back to the other group, the original group, if you want to call it original, and it was a mess. And that's when Lester come in and bought it. And, you know, Mr. Ward, all those years. Now, you got to remember, he had two of the best towns in the state besides Atlanta. Now, that's back when Little Eagle and them was here, and I don't know if it was McIntyre or Dunkel had just taken over or what, but they started doing to him what they did here in Savannah when the split come. They started sending him this, I mean, no talent, none whatsoever. I mean, none. And I remember I was probably 12 years old, maybe a little younger. We'd go to the matches. It was so bad, we would leave. That's when he was running. He was getting just anybody, Tarzan White, just, you know, who was late in his career, Honey Boy Hannigan, if y'all remember that name. Just yep. Anybody he could get to run, and then things worked out, and they got back together. And
yeah,
you know, he...
Yeah, just to put a little reference to that, that was July 63. He split off from the Atlanta office, and... May 64, they were back together.
The Atlanta office, what they did, they would come down and they went to Phoenix City to run. I know Little Eagle was over there, because I never went to the matches. You know, ride by there, but you know, the talent was from, you know, the Georgia office then, and it all worked out. But it was like the split here when that happened, you know. Here I am, I'm married to Aaron Newman, who was a promoter here. I was married to his daughter, and then I hadn't been in the business no time. And
when did you actually start working, Jerry?
1970.
Okay, so you had worked in the Atlanta office before the split, right?
That is correct.
That's the way I remembered it. I was going to try to ask you about that. And then you were gone. Were you not gone when the split took place?
I was gone. Ted had never worked here in Georgia. Ted and I were in Montgomery working for Bill Golden. And I got I had gone to Mobile for a while, and then I went up there for Golden, and then I got booked back here in Georgia. And then I had a starting date. But from the time I got my starting date till the time I actually got here, that's when Gunko died here in Savannah, and then when I come back, well, I went with who booked me, which was Tom, because Tom was the booker here when I first started here. So I'm going, whoa. So
that must have been a really bizarre situation for you, you know, with your family relations and everything, and friendship with Dick Steinborn, and then your brother just trying to start out, and then trying to make a professional decision on what you needed to do.
It was horrible. Here I am caught in the middle. So Mr. Newman, he went with Tom and all that, and they flew down here to Savannah. You can't do that. You got to do. He didn't know what to do, and of course I hadn't been in the business that long, and I'm just sitting here waiting, deciding what to do. And Mr. Ward called me, and now Mr. Newman goes back with not the really original group, but the new group now, which is going to be Lester Welch and that crowd. So I'm caught in the middle, and so they call Ted to come to work for Gunkel.
Right.
So he does. So I'm working for one office, and he's working for another, and we didn't care. He and I didn't care. You know, we both had jobs. We, you know, I've been in the business a little longer than Ted, and he was just happy to have work. So it worked out good for him because he really learned how to work. Him and Cowan did all those great things, and that was good for them. And so the splits, you know, rocking along, and all this talent's coming from everywhere. They're coming up. Eddie Graham's coming from Florida. They're sending Matt Suter up here. They're doing this and this and this. So now it's really getting serious. So even though I've only been in the business a short time, I've been around it all my life and traveled the roads with Dickie, you know, in the beginning and all that. So what they did, they took me on Atlanta TV, beat me two hours, they beat me every Saturday on TV. You know what they was doing? Putting me on the main event here in Savannah, working a program with Tarzan Tyler. Now, where's the logic? Here I am, been in the business right at 2 years. So I go back to Columbus and I tell them, I said, look, I said, I told Ralph Reed and Fred Ward, I said, look, I said, I called him Mr. Ward. He was always Mr. Ward to me. I said, I don't know what y'all know about what's going on in Savannah. I said, but I see the handwriting on the wall. If they sent somebody down here to, like, oversee the town, I'm going, they're trying to take the Savannah from Mr. Newman, which he's had it for, I don't, God knows how long. Oh, no, you don't understand. I said, no, I understand. I said, would you want your main eventer getting beat every Saturday on TV?
Right.
And then being in the main event, I said, I'm not stupid. Well, that Friday night, I mean, it was loaded with people. I mean, it was loaded. I mean, guys were coming from everywhere. And I always dress downstairs. So I was coming up the steps, and here's somebody that I respected. I thought he was probably had one of the greatest heads in the business, Eddie Graham. He's coming down the steps. So I started down there, you know, in Florida. So he said, man, he said, I need to talk to you. I said, sure, Eddie. I said, you know, it's good to see you, man. I said, you know, what's going on? He said, look, he said, you know, he said, you kind of don't understand about what's going on. I said, Eddie, I said, I've haven't been in the business that long, but I know what's going on. I said, this deal down there in Savannah. I said, there's something wrong with that picture, Eddie. He said, yeah, well, we just trying to secure everything and all that and this and this and this. I said, Eddie, would you have some guy who's been in the business like me right at 2 years and beat him on TV on Saturdays or whenever your show is, and then have him on main events in some of your towns? He said, no, I sure wouldn't. I said, well, that's what they're doing with me. And I said, that's not right. He said, no, it's not right. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, this thing will work out. He said, it'll all work out. He said, but, and which I never did. I probably should have. He says, when you leave here, I want you to come back to Florida. He said, you're the perfect size guy. He said, you can work with the biggest guys and you can work with the smallest guys. He said, you're the perfect height, you're the perfect size. He says, when you get ready to leave here, call me. And I never did, and I never went back down there. But that was my story, and that's what happened to me. And it worked out all right. It worked out all right for everybody. I hated to see what happened to Ann Gunkel, regardless. I mean, that was wrong. Ray Gunkel was a hard, hard, hard-nosed man to work for. That's the way he was. If you knew it, then that's the way it was. Like, Ole was hard-nosed. I got along great with Ole. I knew it, and I worked with some of the hardest-nosed guys in the business, and I always did my job, and I never had any trouble with any of them. But what they did to her was wrong. It was dead wrong. And I admire the guys that went that way, and I admired what they did, and it was good for everybody there for a while.
And obviously, with Ted, Ted just starting out, it was probably he was going to get a better push and everything going with the All-South group. So that was probably
It was the best thing for him. Tomlin, that's was so smart, so slick, so clever. And even though Ted was green like I was, he could do whatever they needed to be done, even at that early age. And they did that thing with him and Calvin, and Bobby was right there in the middle of that. He knows what that was. I mean, that was
them policemen
so
in Atlanta thought that was a shoot.
Exactly.
And I was in the ring with them 100 times, and it was about 99. I thought it was a shoot.
Well,
them guys beat the crap out of each other.
So what they did, they did the thing with me that they had done with Spears and Soto. They did a thing with me and Spears and Columbus, and that rocked and rocked and rocked, and it helped me, because they didn't want me to leave to go over there.
Right.
Which that wouldn't have killed them at all, but, I mean, they just didn't. I mean, both of us being right there from Columbus. So they would ask me every week, they said, on Mondays, we were still running the bell, and Bobby, y'all were running a skate sun or something up there?
Oh, we lost the bell, we ran a bowling alley, an old bowling alley.
You could do a whole show just talking about the All-South split and all the political ramifications and personal feelings about that. I mean, between Bobby and Jerry here, there's so much material, and there's people that would really be interested in hearing that kind of stuff, which we are tonight.
I know Rich is probably pulling his hair out. I got off from Fred Ward to this, but it's part of the Fred Ward situation, but the last thing on all that, Ted and I would ride. We'd ride together to Augusta. If he would drive, he'd drop me off at the Bell. He'd go on to where he was going, and vice versa. And we'd come home together. I mean, that had nothing to do with our relationship or nothing. He had a job, I had a job, I did my job, he did his job. And what that did for me, because they would always ask me, how much did Ted make last week? Well, I don't know if I got the numbers exactly right, but my checks were pretty good.
As long as yours cleared the bank, you were satisfied, right?
They did all right with me. I know one night I was off, and I don't know what night it was, and Dickie was off, and of course he's still with Gunkel, and he's promoting Columbus, and he said, how many times you worked last week? I said, I ain't worked but three times, man. He said, how much did you make? I said, $520. I'll never forget it. He turned him in the chair over right in the restaurant. Right, and he splattered right on the floor. He said, $520 for three shots? I said, that's what I got. I don't know what the rest of them got. So that was good money back then.
Yeah, oh, hey, it was very good money. I'll just say this. Go ahead, Jerry.
No, I just said it was, like you said, we could do a whole show on that because Bobby was on one side and I was on the other.
Well, it got me my start. That's when I started doing ring announcing, on television was when that split happened because of the way, things went with the announcers and whatnot. So it certainly was beneficial for me. But just Fred Ward in general, I'll say that the first live event that I ever saw was a Fred Ward promotion, and I had really never, knew anything about him before that. I was from Atlanta, so I knew Paul Jones and where he promoted. But when I left WPLO in 1971, I went down to WJAZ in Albany, Georgia, they were running spots. Fred Ward was running spots for the little fairgrounds down there in Albany where they were holding matches that summer. And the first live professional wrestling I ever saw was at that fairgrounds, and it was a Fred Ward, promotion. And that's how I first learned about him. And I remember that the main event that I saw that night was the guy that I'd seen on TV, the Assassins against Bill Dromo and Bob Armstrong. And, it was exciting. And that's where I actually got my interest in thinking about maybe trying to take my announcer skills into the wrestling business. So Fred, just seeing that show and introducing me to Fred Ward was something that makes his name embedded in my memory. But man, you've got a lot of information there.
Well, he was on the show, he would come out, and Bobby's, he just knows this by heart. He would come out, the show would open, Jim Carlisle would be there, and he'd just say, "I want to say hello to all my sick and shut-in friends. I hope you'll be up and at them real, real soon." That was his spiel, and you didn't see him the rest of the show. He's gone.
And people loved him for it.
Yeah, they loved him, and he was very influential in Columbus, Georgia. Very. I know when Aflac got started, John Amos started Aflac there in Columbus, Georgia. He was going around door to door selling his insurance policies. So Mr. Ward told me this story himself. Eddie Graham bought some, this one bought some, blah, 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 this one bought, you know, blah, blah, blah. So years, I'm talking about years later, like in the 80s, this wrestler bought some named Jack Bentz. Y'all remember that name?
Yeah, I remember it.
Yep.
So Jack Bentz is living in Portland, Oregon. And he called Mr. Ward and he said, "Fred, you know that insurance that you got us to buy back then?" He said, "When I left Georgia, I forgot all about that insurance. I don't know how much he bought, maybe $250 worth. I don't know the amount." He said, "Yeah, Mr. Ward made a fortune off of Aflac." So anyhow, he said, "Could you check into that and see if I got a few dollars in there?" Well, Mr. Ward, he called over there and talked to him. He knew who to talk to him, blah, 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 blah. He called Jack Bentz back there in Oregon, out in Oregon, because he was going to buy a piece of equipment. He was in the, doing driveways or roads or something. I don't know. He wanted to buy a big piece of equipment. So he called him. He said, "Jack, I got what you got in there." He said, "How much I got in there, Fred?" He said, your stock is $68,000. He said, Bentz almost had a heart attack. So I don't know what the other guys did, you know. Yeah, he was always good to me. I mean, nothing out of the ordinary or, you know, give me $1,000 a week. But he was always fair to me.
Yeah, looking back through history, he first started working in conjunction with the Atlanta office as early as I could tell, January 51. Because I know in December 50 he was still promoting independently of Atlanta. But the earliest I've got him promoting was, I want to say, the fall of 1947. And I actually got to meet Ralph Freed right before GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com launched back in 2002. I met him briefly in passing, and I actually said to Ralph, I said, I'd love to talk to you sometime because I'm sure you can tell me a lot about Fred's promotion, this, that, and the other. And he says, "Oh yeah, we can do that." And I said, "Yeah, as I understand it, he was running opposition to Paul Jones and his group before he joined up with them." And his response back to me was, "No, Paul Jones was running opposition to us." So that's what they thought.
Can I tell you one other story about him, and I'll leave it alone?
Oh, absolutely.
When he started promoting Macon, now Fred Ward had a real twin. I met him. His name was Tommy. You know, Mr. Ward wrestled as Tommy Ward, too.
Yes. Right.
So his real twin brother was named Tommy, and I met him. It was like night and day. Mr. Ward was short, squatty, and thick. His brother was lean and tall, and he lived in Miami. It had nothing to do with the wrestling business. So when I show you how smart he was back then. When he started, and he was still wrestling, when he was first started promoting Macon, the promoter was Tommy Ward, which was Fred Ward. And the wrestler was Fred Ward. He was the same person. Twins. And he pulled that off.
I love
That's
it.
Pretty slick, I think.
I love it.
I always wondered about that, and I'm glad you cleared that up.
He told me the story.
I assume he wrestled Yeah, I knew he wrestled as Tommy Ward, and then I'd see Tommy Ward wrestling and Fred Ward, the promoter. And I was just kind of
wondering
about that. It made me second guess.
He told me the story. That's like something you watch on Columbo.
But his brother's name was Tommy, correct?
Yes, he was. I met him. Yeah, he lived in Miami.
You know, today they'd get somebody for identity theft off of something like that, but
But I thought that was the slickest thing
I ever
heard.
When I first went to work for Barnett, when I came over and went to work for Barnett, Harley was a booker, and I went over on Monday. You know, I went in that first Monday morning, and I walked back there, and Harley was Harley said, I'm going to send you to Waycross tonight. And I said, okay. And then he said, you'll be off Tuesday and Wednesday. And I said, all right. He said, Mr. Ward don't want to use you. And I said, why? He said, well, he said, you were the opposition is what he says. And I was dating a girl from Columbus. My first wife was from Columbus. We weren't married yet, but we were dating. And he said, you're dating a girl from Columbus. It's just not good for business, and he don't want to use you. And I said, well, whatever. You know, I don't even know him. I said, I'd never met him. I said, what? You know, I'll just do what y'all want me to do. And then, so I was basically working Mondays, Thursdays, some Friday nights, and then, of course, holidays, or, you know, TV on Saturday morning and show Saturday night. And Barnett put me on a guarantee. I was working part-time in the office and then doing a referee, and I made the same thing no matter how much I worked, so I really didn't care. And just to show you how things go, it's, you know, what have you done for me lately? Ronnie West was supposed to referee Macon TV. They were doing Macon TV on Thursday afternoons. And something happened. Ronnie's car broke down or something happened, and he couldn't get from Cleveland to Atlanta to go down there. So it's 2 hours before their TV, and they got no referee. So I was at the arena, and Harley called me in. He said, need you to go to Macon TV? And I went, now, wait a minute. I said, am I going to get any grief down there? And he said, no. He said, Mr. Ward may not be there. He said, a guy named Choo Choo Lin runs TV for him. He said, you meet him. He said, you'll be fine. And he said, ain't nobody going to say nothing. He said, you know, you go down there and do what you got to do. And he said, then I think I was even off that night. That's all I did. So I went down there, and I met, that's the first time I ever met Choo Choo. And Choo Choo, first time he looks at me, he goes, oh, you that kid from the opposition. And I said, yeah, that's me. And he goes, okay. And we did the TV, but Mr. Ward was there. He come up to me. He shook my hand. He introduced himself. Said, I'm glad you came down. Thank you for coming down here and do this. And, you know, from that point forward, I worked every night of the week. Never had another crossword with him. And it was just he didn't want to use me until he needed me. And all of a sudden, boom, here I am.
It's interesting how that happens, but what it actually did for you was took away your days off.
Yeah, it opened the door for me. You know,
sure.
Back then, I was young and dumb and wanted to work every day.
Well, I did the same thing, so I know exactly. You know, sometimes I'd work three jobs in one day, so it was, sure, I understand.
You know, later on when we were working them 21, 22, 23-day stints where we didn't have an off day, I started appreciating them off days a little more, but, you know, I was still a kid, man. It was fun to me. I couldn't wait for time to go.
That kind of happened to me when I started. I moved to Orlando, and that's where Dickie was living. That's where I started. You know, he trained me and all that. So he trained me in Milo's gym. And so Dickie was doing the program for Milo. So he asked me, he said, you want to come out there to the sports arena and sell programs? I said, yeah. So I was out there every week selling programs. So something happened with the guy. This guy's name was Oop. He worked at the Milo's gym, and he was a timekeeper, bell ringer and timekeeper. So something screwed up, and Eddie was there that night. He went berserk. I forgot what happened. So Eddie went to Milo and said, look, he said, we got to have another timekeeper. You got to get rid of that guy. He said, Dick's brother-in-law is selling programs, and, you know, Dick's training him, you know, be a wrestler. He said, let me meet him. So I met him, and Eddie said, you're the timekeeper. You're the timekeeper. You know, you call out 5 minutes gone, 10 minutes remaining, blah, 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 and ring the bell. I said, okay. So I finally got booked, you know, here and there. So Milo goes to Eddie and tells him, don't book me in Orlando. So I didn't know anything about it. So I wanted to wrestle in Orlando, you know. And so I asked Dickie, I said, what was that about? He said, look, he said, my dad don't want you wrestling here. He said, everybody knows you started selling programs. Then you were the timekeeper. He don't want you wrestling here. I said, whatever. I never wrestled there, ever. That's the way it was. I can see that in a way, you know. So there's my story, Bobby.
I love it. That's the first time I've heard that one. Right? That's good.
And all I still hadn't wrestled there.
What's that?
I said, everybody's got a story. But I didn't mean to take up so much time with the other Rich.
Oh, no, man. Hey, it's a long show. Hey, next name we want to bring up, it's another guy that Jerry carried bags for, refereed and all that. I'm not exactly going to expect you guys to pick up on this, but Henry Weber took over promoting in November 1929. After Earl McCrory, after he quit promoting that summer, he had taken over after John Contos, who we talked about a little bit last week, had his automobile accident and had to stop promoting in Atlanta. Henry Weber promoted from November 29 through his death in April 1936. He was having some kind of heart trouble, not sure exactly what it was, but I'm guessing maybe heart disease. But he died 49 years old. He was sick for several months, but football star from Georgia Tech, Frank Spear, had been wrestling and actually had been kind of running the show while Weber was sick, and he took over as promoter after that. But Weber had that six-and-a-half-year run where he basically had the run of the Atlanta City Auditorium for, you know, some 6-7 years with all the top names coming through at the time, as they did in all the major cities back then. He actually, in doing some research, interestingly enough, I would say the first true wrestling war in Georgia actually took place in 1932. L.C. Warren, who we kind of touched on last week, and he actually kind of resumed promoting after Frank Spear died in 1938, but he, of course, subbed the Warren Arena. And Eddie Hanlon started promoting wrestling cards at the City Auditorium on opposite dates from Henry Weber, and they were using different talent. That went on for about 3 months before Weber was able to, as I understand it, get an exclusive deal on the arena, which I'm guessing was probably what ended up in place there, up at least until Ann Gunkel.
Well, I think you pretty well covered that, Chris. You know, I certainly don't have anything to add to it. I Googled the guy and everything else, couldn't find anything about him other than what, you know, you had out there, but this is, once again, this has been educational for me, just like the his predecessor, hearing this promotion information.
And Jerry, is there anything you can tell us about it?
I used to drive for him. That's all. Rich, you dirty dog.
All right, the next guy on the list from the class of 2004. Tim Woods as Mr. Wrestling number one, or actually as Mr. Wrestling at first, but take it.
Well,
I guess he was the hottest thing that ever hit at that time.
He was the first baby face I ever saw or heard of with a mask on. And Garibaldi did such a wonderful job of building him up. He was over before he ever got here.
That he was, Bobby. There's no doubt about it.
It was such great anticipation of him coming that he just, I mean, when he was here, man, like I say, he you don't see that anymore. But, yeah, I'm glad you agreed with that, Jerry. That's just, he was, if it's possible, he was over before he got here. All he had to do was come in and you know, perform.
And let me piggyback on just that statement real quick, and just point out something that happened. In one of the programs, right before he got here, they actually had a picture of him superimposed over the skyline of Atlanta.
Yes.
You guys remember that photo?
Yes.
I remember that picture.
That kind of goes with what you're saying.
I remember that.
Yep.
But, Bobby, I don't know how long they plugged him, like 3 months before he got here?
Oh, yeah, before he got here. Yeah.
Are you talking about his original run here?
Yes.
Yes, yes. When Garibaldi was here.
And, you know, I mean, there's other guys, if you look in the business, that have used the Mr. Wrestling moniker for periods of time. But certainly, when you think about it, the name that comes to mind is, of course, Tim Woods, and he is the legitimate Mr. Wrestling. But there were other guys that used that name. But I can remember when he was here at one point during his early run. I don't know if the lady was his wife or not, but he had a lady come out who had a mask on, and he introduced her as Ms. Wrestling, and I assume it was his wife at the time. But that was during his original run. But, you know, he obviously is, once again, one of the guys that were brought in here to help during the early days of the All-South Atlanta office split. And had there not been a Mr. Wrestling number one, there never would have been a Mr. Wrestling number two.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, he was one of those guys with his amateur background and his abilities to speak as a babyface. You know, and a crowd pleaser that really brought some legitimacy to the, to the business because of his background and what he could do in the ring. And so when you would need to drag out somebody that you could say, see, this is not a brawler, this is not just some guy with a gimmick, this is a guy that's got amateur background and has taken that to make himself into a first-class professional wrestler and a top-notch guy. He's got the college, legitimacy and everything else. He was the guy that you wanted on the card. And, of course, with that white mask and the tights and everything else, he was something to see, and he was capable of delivering in the ring. And he was definitely Mr. Wrestling, no doubt about it.
He looked the part and very good talker.
Oh, absolutely.
When Timmy came back in 72, when they brought him back in here when the split happened and the war started or whatever it was called. But the first run when he came in here was 67, 68, I guess.
That sounds right.
And he
came in late 66 and left in the spring of 68.
Okay. When he came in here, Timmy had put on a little weight. I mean, he was not he was still in good shape, but Timmy was not working out like he was when he came in here originally.
Right.
I mean, he was just I don't know. There was just something about him. And the funny thing was, if you was ever in a ring with him, he'd kill you. He was the clumsiest guy.
Oh, don't think
guy,
he wouldn't walk and step all over you.
The clumsiest guy I've ever – the two guys, they're both amateur guys that could pull your lungs out through your ears, him and Jim Raschke, Baron Von Raschke. They would beat you to death if you didn't stay a long way away from them, because they were clumsy, they were awkward, and that's just the way they were. But they were, geez.
Well, their background being amateur, of the standing that they were, they were capable of doing that kind of stuff, which, if you look at it from a business standpoint, was a bit awkward, because it wasn't professional moves.
Right.
I think, I can remember Freddie Miller calling me and saying, do you know who George Wooden is? And I said, are we talking about Tim Woods? And he said, yeah. And this was with the 1975 crash, the plane crash. And once again, for what that guy was willing to do with to protect the business,
mm-hmm.
and in the condition that he was in after that crash, to come back on TV for the Crocketts and keep the kayfabe going by not admitting that he was or making it obvious that he was in that plane was something that, you know, he never will get the credit for that he deserves because it was kept so quiet. But that would, you know, when you look back on it now, that the condition that he was in and what he was willing to do was just unbelievable.
Yep.
He was a nice man, and he was – Timmy was a good guy, man. He really was.
It was a pleasure to see him anytime, you know, he worked. And I can remember his – when he came in the last time for the tag team tournament, and he teamed with two after he was actually retired. And talk about put on weight, he had done that way at the, you know, at the very end, and he was really not in condition anymore. But once again, that was kind of like a, you know, something to, you know, just to do for the office. I was, you know, I got to see him in one of his last matches that he had before he really did, you know, quit for good. And it was always a pleasure to see him work.
He came to Mobile the year he died. He came to Mobile that year. So I got to see Timmy that last time there, and I'm very fortunate. I got a couple of pictures with me and Tim in them, and he looked swollen to me then. But you mentioned his wife. You know, Timmy was only married one time, and his wife's name was Tiger, and that's they were still married when he died.
Wow.
And that was. I remember she used to come to the matches with him, and a drop-dead gorgeous blonde.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to come to the matches with him. But, they were still married when Timmy died. Matter of fact, she's the one that found him in the floor when he had the heart attack.
You know what ended his first run here, don't you?
Oh, went in and told Uncle he wanted more money or something, tried to hold up for more money, didn't he?
It was due to the world title match that he had where he got a bad payoff. Is my understanding.
This is what Dickie told me. She talked him into they were selling out. That was Leo's creation and his genius that he pulled off. They're selling out everywhere. So his wife, Tiger, talks him in to going in to see Gonco, telling him he wants a piece of the action. This is on a Monday. He's booked with Kaninsky all week, everywhere. So he goes in this meeting with Ray Gonkel, telling him, you know, they put you in a position to do all this stuff, even though you're doing what they ask. Telling him he wanted, you know, a piece of the action. He said, really? He said, I'll tell you what, you're done as of right now. So when the meeting was over, he walks out, and Garibaldi said, how did it go? He said, he just fired me. Gonkel comes out and tells Leo, he said, I just fired him. He said, he's booked with Kaninsky all week. He told Garibaldi, that's your problem. So Garibaldi, you know how his mind races? He says, there's only one guy can pull this off. He calls Dickie down in Orlando. He said, look, you got to be up here tonight in Augusta. Told him what he wanted. He hops on a plane. They had the stuff waiting on him. He worked all week as Tim Woods or Mr. Wrestling.
Being under the hood, it was possible to do that.
Well, I got news for you. Dickie's as good an actor as anybody you've ever seen in your life, and he looked the part. He made the moves
did. Here he was down in Florida. He's got a tan. He comes to Savannah. Now, Dickie told me the story because that's the way before I got in the business. He said, Mr. Newman looked at him, and Dickie was smoking a pipe. Mr. Newman says, you're not Mr. Wrestler. He said, Mr. Wrestling never has a tan. You got a tan, and he didn't smoke.
Oh. You know, apparently he did it very well, because there was a couple other times I know Dick had told me, and you know, I found it in the research later. I think they brought him back about 6 months later, advertising him for a big show, and they put him under the hood as Mr. Wrestling, and then I want to say they did it one other time about 2 years later. So, next on the list, yet another guy that Jerry worked for in some capacity. We'll find in a second. Ed Strangler Lewis started working in Georgia back in 1913, and him and Max Bauman and Billy Sandow and that group working mostly in Savannah back then. But through the years, Strangler Lewis would end up working Atlanta quite regularly, all the way up into the late 40s, at least in the ring. As a matter of fact, putting over Don McIntyre in a series of matches in 1947 we were talking about earlier. And in the 50s, he was coming back as a special referee-type deal. And then he was in here when he was working with Lou Fez. He was coming through here as his second, you know, working in the corner there with him. And I want to say the period of about 55 to 57. But Strangler Lewis was the next guy in the group. Jerry, what exactly did you do for Strangler Lewis?
Stayed out of his way. Where was he from, Rich? Was he from St. Louis?
I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up.
You're not
and
sure.
Because of the internet, I can do that. So, bear with me.
Well, he was, what I see is he was born in 1891 and died in 1966, six-time world heavyweight champion. But, you know, he was from the era where professional wrestling still got mainstream media coverage in the newspapers. And I think that's why his name lasted so long, because, you know, the sport during that period, the 30s and 40s, still had the presumed legitimacy to it. And, you know, they may be doing worked shoot matches or shoot worked matches, but they did them in that era like, you know, they would beat long, drawn-out things, and guys would be in a hold for a good period of time. So, you know, people assumed that what they were seeing was legitimate, and in many cases it probably was, because there's always been shooters. But those matches were worked in a shoot-type fashion in that era. Unlike the gimmicks that started to be used in the 50s with Gorgeous George from then on. And so I think that's probably why his name as one of the old-timers is still known as much as it is, because there was press coverage of a lot of the matches that he had.
Did him and Landis work together much?
I don't know. His.
Well, I know they had that big match in Wrigley Field.
Yeah.
And I want to say 1934, 35. I'm sure they had a series of matches in that era. I don't have that information in front of me, but I got a bet that anybody was foolish not to be booking those two together. Now, he was from Wisconsin, Jerry. You were asking about St. Louis. He was from Wisconsin.
Okay.
Yeah. Now also, pulling up some stuff here. Apparently, when he came back in the 40s after semi-retirement, he was actually working Legally Blonde.
Wow.
Kind of interesting. Next on the list, getting in mostly, I'm assuming, for just basically the luck of the draw with Channel 17 and whatnot. And then, obviously, for taking over WCW in the late 80s, running up until, I don't know, the late 90s or whenever it was taken over by, I guess, AOL, Ted Turner.
Well, Mr. Turner was, quite the character about town when we first moved over to Channel 17. Me and Larry Nichols, we did the Baltimore Colt thing, We moved the ring in the middle of the night from Channel 11 down to Channel 17. And there was many Saturdays I would go in to put the ring up and I'd hear strange noises. And one Saturday I went to investigate to see what it was because it was bothering me. I didn't know what it was. It was kind of scary. You know, I was in there by myself. And I found him under his desk. He was slightly inebriated, and he was trying to get out from under the desk, and he couldn't figure out how to get out from under it. So I just, you know, kind of looked at him and went on back downstairs. But he was a huge wrestling fan. He was a closet wrestling fan. He didn't want to, you know, I guess his reputation, he couldn't come right out and say, oh, I'm a wrestling fan. But many Saturdays, there was a catwalk in that old studio there on West Peachtree Street.
Yep.
It was way up top over the top of the lights. And many Saturdays, I've seen him standing up there watching the matches.
I saw him several times also.
Yeah, and he was.
But he made it clear that wrestling is what put TBS on the map.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was the right place at the right time for the wrestling promotion and for him also.
Yeah. There was you know, Barnett was real big into the ratings numbers. I mean, he was always comparing and looking at numbers and things. And there for years, we were the biggest draw that Turner had. Our advertising time sold for more than the Braves did because, of, you know, of course, the Braves were the pits back then. But, yeah, he was showing the Braves, and we were outdrawing them.
I think even the Sunday evening best of show was the ratings were unbelievable for a UHF station at that time, and it worked out for everybody. I just remember him, you know, from when I got out of the Army in the late 60s, early 70s, when I was trying to figure out what I was doing in the broadcasting business, but he had put 17 on the air, and here was this guy that, you know, I didn't really know his background from Turner Advertising or whatnot, but he would be the host of the cheesy Sunday morning movie, it was unbelievable because it was almost tongue in cheek, but really I think he was legitimately thinking he was doing it, as a host would do that show. And it was unbelievable, but, I mean, people would tune in to watch him, not just like they would Bill Tush in the middle of the night, not just to see the movie, but to watch the host, who was the owner of the TV station. And, he took that persona and made millions off of it, you know, down to the fact of growing bison out in the Midwest and in the Western states and having steakhouses that sell it. I mean, he's done everything.
You know,
Channel 17 was a strange place back then when it first started. I mean, you had my first Saturday there to put the ring up for TV, the very first Saturday. I can't, you know, I got there about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I can't get anybody to come to the back door to let me in. So I used my pocket knife to jimmy the door to get in, praying there's no alarm on the door. I get in, and I'm walking down, and I figure, well, I better go through the control room and tell somebody that I'm here so that they don't, you know. So I go through the control room, and there's a guy, I'll never forget it. I don't know who he was. There's one guy there running. And, you know, all they ran was movies and you know, things. I walk in. This guy's sitting at the control panel. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. He's barefooted, pair of jeans on. He's barefooted with his legs crossed. He's strumming a guitar and smoking a joint.
Yep, it was the TV version of WKRP radio.
And running the board.
Yep.
And I said, I'm here to put the ring up for the wrestling. And he goes, oh, okay, man. And I mean, that was it. I mean, it was, you know. Now, Turner hired, he had some great talent there. The guy that directed our show when we first started, his name was R.T. Williams. Great guy, very talented guy. I'm trying to think of the sound guy they had there, Joel something.
Yeah, I remember that guy's name. And these were guys that, you know, they came along late in the business from that standpoint, and they got a chance to do things there at 17 that they wouldn't have gotten a chance to do other places.
Any place, yeah. I mean, they were some very talented people. And you know, Skip Ellison later became our director, and Skip went on to WGN in Chicago, and I think he's still there. He does the Cubs games now. I mean, he's very talented. We had some great guys come through there, and But it was just a very strange place when we first started. And I really thought Gunkel was going to have a heart attack, a stroke, and die at the TV station rather than at the way it happened.
Well, his innovations, at least in terms of what he was doing with Channel 17 over the years, I got to think it only helped make Georgia Championship Wrestling a bigger company than it might have been anyway.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, we made it a superstation. That was the catalyst or the rocket that shot us into the stratosphere.
All right, and last but not least, in the class of 2004, Thunderbolt Patterson.
Are you being silent on purpose, Bobby?
Thunderbolt came to work for us at Gunkel in 73. Could have been early 74. I think it was 73.
Yep.
He came in here and he talked that jive, and he had the moves and he had the talent to perform in the ring. But where he really was great was on that microphone. And he was just what the doctor ordered. I mean, he popped our gates everywhere we went. You put him on a card, buddy, and you sold out there for a good while. And I'm not sure what exactly happened, but I'm sure part of it was him wanting more money, and somehow or some way, some shape, some form, the race card got played some way, and next thing I know, him and Jim Wilson are buying tickets and sitting in the crowd, and it kind of went downhill from there. But I've never had a problem with Thunderbolt. Me and Thunderbolt have always got along well. Been in the ring with him many times. He's a great piece of talent, and I think he deservedly needs to be in a Hall of Fame because he played an important part in a lot of things that went on around here. And you know, he came back later on working for Barnett, and him and Ole were like oil and vinegar, or water and oil. They just didn't mix, and they made it work from a business perspective, but he drew a lot of money. And you know, if you go somewhere now and Thunderbolt's there, he still attracts a crowd.
Oh, yes. Jerry, I'm sure you worked many matches with him, didn't you, Jerry?
Oh, yeah. His big thing was those interviews, that he was always the low man on the totem pole. But you know what? He was always taken care of. I never saw his great. You know, I didn't get that.
What was it like to work in the ring with him?
I never worked with him.
You never worked a match with him?
I've been in some tag matches with him. Oh, he did what he was supposed to do now. He could get it going on.
First time I saw his name was in the 70s when Mid-Atlantic, when they were still basically a tag team area, and he was tagging with Jerry Briscoe as his partner. Never saw them work together, but that's the first time I ever saw a photo of him for a setup for a match. And then when he came to Atlanta, I was quite impressed when I saw what he was capable of doing, both in the ring with his style, which was very unorthodox, and also his abilities, as Bobby said, on the mic. I mean, he could talk it, and they loved it. But he was always fun to watch, both in the ring and doing the interviews. But he was a guy that he was very controversial, and I will say this for him, he would quit and leave, but he was a drawing card because he'd come back, when they wouldn't ask other people to come back just because they wouldn't do it. You know, it just was bad in their, in some people's minds, to do such things as that. But he would be asked to come back because they knew he could draw. And I was very fortunate after I left Georgia Championship Wrestling that I developed not a friendship, but I introduced myself to him, and I had had some conversations with Jim Wilson. But anyway, I did a few of the IWL TV shows for them, and it was just interesting to be around Thunderbolt, just away from the camera and away from his T-Bolt persona. And one thing that we share is our first name's the same, and it's not Jay. But at any rate, he was a fun guy, and I was glad to do that for him. And I did a promo for a TV promo that was on Channel 36 for a couple of matches that they had in Carrollton and a few other places. And I actually got to talk to him a little bit last year at the Nightmare to Remember. He's just one of the guys that controversial, but interesting to watch, and great pleasure to have known and worked with him a little bit.
Go ahead.
I just want to ask Jay real quick. You said you did some TV with him for IWL. Was that in the 81 when he did that?
Yes.
With the 81 turn?
Yep.
Okay.
Channel 36.
All right. Okay, yeah, because I was wondering about that, because he also ran the IWL for a few weeks in the fall of 74 when both GCW and All South were still running, and I wanted to ask about that too. But
yeah, they did a show at the Omni, drew about 6,000 people back then.
Right.
And then had a fight in the office trying to figure out who was going to break the money up, and half the people on the card didn't get paid.
Right. Yes, that's right. Yeah, but it was 81, summer of 81, when I did a couple of shows for him.
I just wanted to find out, what was the did anybody take any of that seriously when they were getting that started? I mean, it was they were both short-lived runs, but, he's working with Jose L. Williams, at least in the 74 version. How was that seen from the other established promotions?
Well, he used talent from, this is way back now. Is that the one he brought the Sheik in on?
You talk about 74 then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't he bring the Sheik in, and he had Wilson, and he used himself, and
well, Jay Strongbow worked for him at that time.
Yeah, Strongbow. I mean, he was using guys that lived here. And guys that weren't working anywhere else, or they were retired, or whatever the case may be.
And he'd also worked for the IWA, which was the I-Horn promotion. So he had some connections there, whatever that was. And he could get guys. He'd get them to come in, and obviously the race card was played, and that helped. And he had enough talent that he could put together one show at the Omni. I think it was, I went backstage there or into the dressing area, and there was some concern about what he was doing, and it was just fear that he can continue to draw. But that was the kind of thing you could do at the Omni one time, but, you couldn't do it again.
You knew from the people that were involved in that, you knew there was going to be a problem with the money. Guys that weren't smart enough to say, hey, I want my money up front. And again, half, three-quarters of the card didn't get paid that night. Because, of course, the Omni's going to get theirs off the top.
Right.
And then you had everybody in the world with their hand out wanting their percentage. And, the guys that got... the guy left holding the bag were the people that actually did the work.
Right. There was a lot of deals made, obviously, to get to get them in there. But there was money made. I mean, I just came to see the show, and like I said, there was a lot of folks that bought tickets. But the house, I would say, I knew what the Omni would hold. It was better than 6,000, and all those. There wasn't a lot of giveaway tickets, I don't think. I mean, I there were serious fans there to see it one time.
Well, even just to looking at the 81 version, which you're talking about, that was on May 3rd or May 3 at the Omni. Jim Wilson and Jay Strongbow against the Samoans, but the Samoans were the actual original Samoans, T.O. and Tapu, and they had T. Bolt against the Sheik. But other guys on that card, Lars Anderson, Ron Garvin, Bob Roop, Bob Orton Jr., Fez Watley, Al Perez, Big Red, Gerald Finley, Terry Gibbs, the Great Malenko, Ted Allen, and Louis Delay.
Well, you know, Lars Anderson had been running a TV show also. And, and so they just kind of threw in together with Big Red and a couple of the guys that he had. And they just took whatever talent they could get, guys that weren't working at the office. It just was an opportunity for them to, you know, get on camera and do whatever they could do. But for some people, it worked out good. For others, it was kind of the kiss of death.
I know they ran a show where they tried. I guess they ran it. They did a show at some point in at Morris Brown College in the Herndon Stadium.
Was that in the summer of 81?
I'm not sure what year this was, but I don't even know how he got my phone number, but Jim Wilson called me, wanted to know if I'd be interested in refereeing. And I...
You were still working for the Atlanta office.
Yeah, and I politely informed him I was retired. And but you know, I didn't want no part of that.
We did a promo for a show that was going to be outdoors, and this was in the summer of '81. And the Sheik was supposed to come in, and at any rate, they ran tapes with him. But at any rate, the weather turned so bad that night. It just was one of those things that, you know, they had to cancel the card. Probably would have, you know, I don't know how it would have gone, but I had agreed to work ring announcer for it. But it was going to be an outside show, and it didn't happen, and it was probably for the best. But at any rate, the weather turned really, really nasty that night. So being an outside card, it was canceled. And that was the last that I worked for.
Well, guys, you got any predictions for the Super Bowl? Anybody got a dog in the fight?
I predict the team with the most points will come out the winner.
And I think Bruno Mars is going to do real well that night.
Yeah. Well, Jay mentioned Nightmare to Remember, just in case anybody's listening that hasn't heard. That show has been canceled. Which I really hate.
Me too. I was really looking forward to it.
I enjoyed doing that the last 3 years and seeing a lot of people that I don't get to see very often. And you know, it just we'll get Jerry fired up again here to the end of the show. The whole thing came about from some group of fine professional wrestlers that had a show in this school about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I'm not sure what they did, but whatever it was bad enough that the parents of some of the students complained to the school board, and the school board yanked the rug out from under everybody from having shows in this school.
That's very unfortunate because, I mean, you know, they ran there last year and they did very well and turned the proceeds of the food over to the school.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a really, really good event. Certainly it was no problem.
Schools made money, and the Sunshine Fund at our reunion has made about $13,000 over the last 3 years from these shows. And so everybody suffers because somebody does something stupid that, you know, I mean, I just, anyway. But I really hate it's been canceled, but just in case anybody didn't know, it has been canceled.
Well, I you know, they didn't go into any specifics on the on what was put on Facebook, but that was my assumption. That was something must have happened there at the school that, you know, said...
Yeah, the school board didn't say they couldn't have shows there, but they said they had to approve everything, and there was no way they wouldn't get together and make an approval where they could guarantee the date, and there's just no way to go about promoting something like that unless you're assured you can have the building. And
right.
It's just too late to try to do anything else and do it in a first-class manner, so they decided just to cancel it.
That's really sad.
Yes, it is.
It is.
All right, guys. Well, not sure about next week yet, but we'll see, and we'll post that information out on GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Anybody got any last thoughts before we wrap up?
I'm looking for some sunshine.
All I say is I enjoyed it tonight.
Yeah, we're looking at 63 or 64 or something on Saturday, so we're back up into the whatever it is. So
they say if you don't like Georgia weather one day, just wait for the next one.
Yeah, so just hang on. It'll change in a couple of hours.
That's about the way it goes. Guys, good show, and we'll talk next time.
Okay.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Good night, everybody.
Enjoyed it. Good night.
Bye.
Blue Joe Daddy.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.